Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, PJ Wilson will talk about bringing solar power to Puerto Rico, followed by a conversation with Evan Smalley, who's bringing us up to speed on sundry issues with the Blue River in Kansas City, Missouri. But first, I'm Naturally with your headline news. E360.yale.edu reports tens of thousands of monarch butterflies that should be in Texas by now, en route to their wintering grounds in Mexico, are still in the northern U.S. and Canada, their migrations delayed due to above-average temperatures and strong winds this fall. After weeks of warmer-than-usual weather, temperatures from the Great Lakes to New England are beginning to fall. Monarchs' muscles stop functioning correctly when temperatures are in the 50s, so scientists warn that unless the butterflies start their 3,000-mile journey south soon, many of them may end up stuck up north and die. Even if they do leave now, many of the plants they eat along the way will be gone by the time they reach them, making starvation a real threat, biologists said. Monarch populations have been in decline for 2 years, plummeting from 1 billion to 33 million in just two decades. Conservation groups and scientists are petitioning to make them a threatened species. Grist.org reports St. Louis just became the biggest Midwestern city to commit to clean energy. Last Friday, Missouri's most populous city voted to obtain 100% of its energy from renewable sources by 2035. The unanimous decision makes St. Louis the 47th city in the United States to commit to a 100% clean energy goal. Some of America's biggest coal companies are based in the city, and Missouri gets about 75% of its electricity from coal plants right now. St. Louis will have to adapt at a rapid pace to keep up with its pledge. It currently gets only 5% of its electricity from renewable sources, and it has fewer than 20 years to close the gap. So far, businesses are on board. Major employers in St. Louis, like Walmart and Nestle Purina, have already pledged support for the 100% renewable energy goal. NRDC.org reports Ameren, Missouri, the Show Me State's largest utility, is finally coming around to clean energy. In a significant shift, the nation's second most coal-reliant utility announced last week its plan to dramatically increase wind and solar investments and significantly cut carbon pollution. Up until now, Ameren's generation portfolio was made up almost exclusively, of coal and nuclear sources. But the company is now recognizing the cost-effective technologies of today and the future, namely solar and wind. In its IRP, Ameren laid out its plans to invest in at least 700 megawatts of wind generation by 2020 and 100 megawatts of solar projects in the next decade. These investments are by far the biggest ever investments in renewable energy by Missouri's largest utility. The new plan also marks a big step forward considering Ameren's current generation fleet. Coal makes up nearly 70% of its generation, while solar and wind make up less than 1% of the supply. And finally, GreenAbilityMagazine.com reports, it's now easier for bicyclists to ride from downtown to the crossroads. The city of Kansas City, Missouri, opened new bike lanes in October, linking the two popular areas along Grand Boulevard from the River Market to 20th Street. The completion of the Grand Boulevard bike lanes wraps up the first phase of the two-phase downtown bike loop project. This project will continue into spring 2018. Cyclists can rent bikes at 20th and Grand from Bike Walk KC's Kansas City B-Cycle Bike Share service. For more information on the downtown bike loop project and other bike projects in the city, please, you're invited to visit Kansas City's website, kcmo.gov/publicworks/bikeKC. At this time, I'd like to turn the show over to Mr. Mike Murphy.
Thank you very much, Natural E. We've got a great show. We're going to have Evan Smalley on in a little bit talking about the Blue River, but this just came up a little while ago. We've got PJ Wilson on the phone from Columbia, Missouri. He's formerly with Renew Missouri, and now he's embarking on a new adventure to bring solar power to Puerto Rico. So are you there, PJ?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on the show today. Thanks for hosting.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for being here. So you're heading for Puerto Rico on Friday.
I actually am. Yeah, I'm going to be flying down there. I'll be down there for 18 days, at least during this first trip. And my primary mission is to bring as much solar off-grid battery charging and lighting as I can with me, and then have shipped more reinforcements along the way. There's still more than 75% of the power is, or the island is without power. It's now officially the worst blackout in the history of this country. And it doesn't look like it's going to get better very soon. So while there are some big solar companies and some big big projects going on to rebuild the island as soon as possible, it is going to be a long slog, and the rural communities are going to be the last ones get connected to the grid.
Yeah, I guess
so. That's my philosophy there, is if I can arrive and bring as much, just solar lighting and cell phone charging. Right now people are traveling an hour or two to go be able to call family and just tell them they're okay. If I can help them get their cell phones charged up and to be able to see at night, I think it'll help the recovery efforts.
That's great. So you're looking at this as a for lack of a better word, a permanent solution, or is this a stopgap measure until, for lack of a better term, regular electricity is used?
Well, that is a really good question. My approach is that initially it's going to be a stopgap measure. Like right now, if people are really hurting because they don't have basic electricity needs, and I want to get in there and funnel resources to get as many sort of Band-Aids put on the problem as possible from the front end. But then ultimately, whether the island rebuilds in a sustainable way or they just kind of rebuild the same grid they have before and are equally vulnerable to hurricanes in the future is a conversation that I plan to get involved in as well.
Okay, so what did you have to do to, like in terms of, did you have to register with the government of Puerto Rico or the U.S. to say, hey, I'm planning on going down there to do this, or are you just showing up, or how does that work out?
That's one of the first questions people ask me, like, are you going down there with an organization, or... And as of now, no, I'm just showing up down there. I'm combining my experience. I'm from Missouri. I've spent the last 10 years developing the renewable energy industry here in the state, working with some other great organizations that have been around longer than I have, like Missouri Coalition for the Environment out of St. Louis and the Sierra Club. Really, when we started 10 years ago, we had no renewable energy in Missouri, and we didn't even have the basic policies we needed in place to do it. So really built from scratch the renewable energy movement here in Missouri. Before that, I did the Peace Corps in Central America for 2 years, so I speak enough Spanish to get by. And my philosophy is that I can show up, bring as much direct assistance with me as possible, and network with all of the clean energy foundations and nonprofits and companies that I'm in contact with to help funnel the resources as quickly as possible into the right place. In any sort of disaster recovery scenario, there's an element of chaos involved, and you end up with too many supplies going to one place and no supplies going to another. So that's something that I think I'll be able to help out with by being on the ground a lot more than I could just from here in Missouri.
Yeah, I see. So what are you bringing with you?
Good question. So I am bringing, right now I have ordered enough supplies to equip 11 houses with very small solar electric and battery systems. So just the sort of the same kind of stuff you'd take with you if you go camping. The sort of, they're about the size of a laptop, and then they unfold to be about the size of your dinner table. Solar that you can just like hang out of your window, point it at the sun or put it on the ground or tip it towards the sun, and then that plugs into a small battery pack that you then plug your USB charging cord in for your cell phones, but you can also plug lights into it as well. So I'm basically going to be arriving with enough solar equipment to equip 11 houses with cell phone charging and lighting. But that is because I've only raised about $4,000 of my $25,000 goal. So if I can hit my goal, ultimately I want to be able to equip 150 houses with a sort of minimal off-grid solar setups.
So how are you fundraising?
Good question. There is there's crowdfunding websites out there, and I found that the best fit for this project is called Generosity, Generosity. It's a offshoot of Indiegogo. It's actually a part of Indiegogo.
Okay.
And one thing that's great about them is that they don't keep any, they don't charge any fees. So whatever's given through their site, 100% of it goes to the person who's raising money for the cause, just minus the 2 or 3% credit card fees that they have to pay themselves.
Right. So, What's if someone were looking for this, is it called Solar Puerto Rico? Is that what the people would look for on this site?
Yeah, it's called Solar for Puerto Rico, F-O-R, Solar for Puerto Rico. So if you go to Generosity's website and you put in solar, it's the first one that comes up there right now. Also just launched a website yesterday called solarforpuertorico.org. So if you just go to solarforpuertorico.org and click on donate, it'll take you straight to that website. It's kind of a bare-bones website right now, but the idea is that's where there'll be updates that I post as I'm getting ready to go on this trip. And then once I'm down there, I don't know how good internet access will be, but I assume I'll be able to make some updates there and take pictures and short videos of the people that are actually putting these systems in place. There's also a Facebook page. If you go on Facebook and just type in Solar for Puerto Rico, it'll come up there. I'm doing some blog entries and keeping people in the loop that way. So if I had a magic wand, I would say to all your listeners, go to the Facebook page and just click like on Solar for Puerto Rico. That'd be the easiest way to stay in touch. And if any of your listeners are sitting there wondering how else they can help, then certainly meeting our financial goal would go directly to getting more systems with solar.
Yeah, that's great. So do you see this as the first of more than one trip? Do you expect to get all this done in 18 days or what?
My goal is to get 150 houses with off-grid solar setups during the 18 days when I'm down there. And then I believe my next trip is going to be in January. After I'm down there, I'm sure I'll be networked with all the organizations on the ground and have a better idea about how I can go back the next time, maybe do 1,500 houses the next time I go down.
Right.
There's a lot of organizations already working on this. Just this week, Google's Project Loon is going live. This seemed like kind of a crazy idea maybe in the last couple of years, but they've got this project where they fly high-altitude hot air balloons and are able to stream high-speed data to cell phones across the island.
Wow.
That is going operational as of this week, my understanding.
Wow, that's interesting. That's interesting. So anything else that we should let our listeners know? I think we've given them the website and the Facebook, but it certainly bears repeating. Or anything else? Are you looking for volunteers in addition to funding?
Yeah, actually, there's volunteer opportunities down there from the Red Cross takes just sort of general anybody that wants to swing a hammer or has medical kind of skills. I would love some help volunteer wise. I got two volunteers helping me already, but it's already too much for me to keep up with the communication with folks offering help. So if any of your listeners just want to volunteer their time, then I'd be happy to put them to good use. I did just get off the phone with the foundation, Tesla's foundation, that they founded to help get solar in needy areas. And talking to the executive director there, he informed me that the policies there on the ground in Puerto Rico are basically the same as what Missouri's were 10 years ago. Net metering is illegal. Their big utility company is very hostile towards people setting up microgrids. So it might be that there's some policy changes in the works as well that need to happen down there. I think that's only going to be further hampered by their canceling of their $300 million contract to rebuild. I mean, right now there's literally no one rebuilding the infrastructure since they canceled the contract yesterday with Whitefish.
Mm-hmm.
So that's only going to make the solar work all the more important. Anyone that's interested, like, please, and you can send me a direct message on the Facebook if anybody's listening and has anything in mind that could help, from money to volunteer time to anything that I might not even be thinking about. It really is. Imagine if it was the state of Missouri and it was 6 weeks after some sort of tornado hit us and we still had the vast majority of the state without power.
Right.
And people are unemployed. They can't travel around. The roads haven't been rebuilt. It is a really dire, it's a humanitarian situation. So anyone that has connections, friends and family that live down there that they want to connect me with, and I'm following up with all leads to that regard as well.
Well, that sounds terrific. And so, PJ, you're going to be on our sister community radio station, KOPN, in Columbia tomorrow at this time with Mark Heim on Evening Edition. Is that right?
That's true, yeah. So anyone wants to listen in, I believe that's going to be an entire hour-long show. So KOPN.org, you can listen live stream there. And if anybody wants to call in, that would be an opportunity to have some back and forth on the air experience as well. But otherwise, yeah, just go to solarforpuertorico.org or find us on Facebook. Just search for Solar for Puerto Rico and get plugged in that way.
All right, that sounds great. All right, PJ Wilson, good luck to you, and keep in touch with us. We'd like to follow up with you on this, okay?
That's a pleasure. Yeah, I'd love to be back on the show again. I could perhaps even when I'm down there phone in and give you a live update or when I come back, either way.
That sounds great. Okay, thanks PJ.
Again.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was PJ Wilson, and he's with Solar for Puerto Rico going down there. Seems like a massive effort there to make that happen. We're going to switch directions after this break. Evan Smalley will be with us talking about the Blue River.
Leaky Lavatories on this current cast. Would you flush hundreds of gallons of unused water down the drain each day? Probably not. But if you have a leaky toilet, you could be wasting that much without knowing it. Karen Worth of the Environmental Protection Agency's WaterSense program explains how to check your toilet for leaks.
If you have a tank-type toilet, place a few drops of food coloring in the tank. If that color shows up in the bowl within like 15 seconds without flushing it, that's a sure sign that you have a leak in your toilet.
The most common cause is a worn-out flapper, which is easy and inexpensive to fix. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Richard Heinberg.
So if you know that extreme events may be headed your way, what's your best policy? What's your best strategy? Well, building resilience, the ability to absorb disturbance while maintaining your essential function and structure.
Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
For 30 years, KKFI has been supported by listeners just like you. Thank you for being there for us so we can be there for you. To help sustain independent community radio, go to kkfi.org and click donate.
All right, here we are back in the studio, Eco Radio KC, here on our last program of October. My name is Mike Murphy. Joining me here in the studio is Evan Smalley. Hello, Evan.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Well, thanks for sitting there patiently during that first interview.
It's a great privilege to be able to actually talk with people and have a way to get the concerns that we have about the river and the waterways in where we live.
So we're going to be speaking about the Blue River in particular tonight, and I know that's something that's near and dear to you, and we can, let that unfold as the program progresses. But let's start with the basics. Like, tell us what the Blue River is. Where does it start? Where does it end?
Well, the Blue River starts by the meeting of two creeks in Kansas, just south of about 167th and Antioch. And then it flows all through South Kansas City, through Martin City, and it flows through Kansas City and has been changed quite a bit by the Corps of Engineers from a free-flowing river once it gets near Kansas City into a pretty much just a waterway.
Mm-hmm. So it's not something that you could canoe through the city on.
Well, you could, but don't fall over.
Yeah. So it ultimately feeds into the Missouri River.
Sure.
And where does that happen?
I have no idea.
So,
sorry.
But I mean, is it east of Jackson County or is it in Jackson County? Do you know?
I think it's in Jackson County. I think it's just north of the Leeds area. I really honestly have no idea.
Well, so it's, could be even within Kansas City. Okay. So, And so we know the Indian Creek flows into it. Are there anything else? Are there other tributaries that feed into it?
Sure, there's Brush Creek, and there's lots of creeks, you know, just throughout the city. I mean, the creek that runs along Ward Parkway where I grew up. We used to get in there and go wading and bother crawdads. I don't think you'd want to do that anymore.
Right. So you're talking about the Brush Creek itself, are you talking about that
was actually a creek by the Ward Parkway Shopping Center.
Right.
So,
yeah.
There's you know.
Oh, that one. Okay. Yeah. I know.
I mean, the whole area, basically all the water empties into the Blue River.
Right. Okay. Okay. So is it used for recreational purposes?
It used to be. And there's a lot of beautiful old prints that you can get of people canoeing and having fun by the river. But now, because it's been so hurt, so distressed, it's become, unfortunately, a lot of it pretty much an open sewer, an open runoff with everything that our civilization produces.
So let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, you literally mean sewer runoff, right?
Yeah, because of what's called combined sewer overflow, where because we have a sewer system now that they're trying to work on that combines both rainwater and sewer water. When the rains get really hot, heavy, then unfortunately it pushes all the sewer water out into the rivers.
So for those of us who are concerned about that and want to minimize our own impact on that, so is it best not to, like, for example, shower when it's raining? Should you avoid that?
I don't think that that's necessarily the answer. I think what's important is to be, because I don't think you're that kind of contribution is going to make that much difference compared to all the water that's coming down in the rain. But what it does inform us is that everything that we put down our drains, especially when it rains, will end up in the river. Mm-hmm. And all the creatures that depend on it are going to have to try to earn a living with all the stuff that we put into the river.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you can see when you go down the river, if you can see that there's not many creatures still living on the river. There used to be some beavers, and you'd see beaver tree chewed up, and you'd see lots of ducks and geese and stuff like that. But they're becoming more and more few.
Well, we had an interesting summer. We had these, I think, three like really heavy rainfalls spaced over the course of maybe a month or so. But there were three of them. First one, I think we had 7 inches or something like that. And, you know, we know what that did to Indian Creek and Cochise and all that. Maybe a week after that, I went walking. I parked over what's the name of the street? I'm going to say Lydia, like off of Bannister there.
Sure, Lydia.
And got, you know, there's a trail along the Indian Creek there, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I followed that trail from the Indian Creek to the Blue River. So it basically, you're heading east on Indian Creek, and then I, you know, made a left at the Blue River to follow that heading north. So this is basically kind of forming like an L or something around the Bannister Federal Complex.
Right. And that's right where I live.
Wow.
So I own a place on top of the Blue River Parkway.
Is
very pretty.
Yeah. That's a beautiful road too. It's a gorgeous road.
Yeah. And I mean, this area is so beautiful. And if you drive down it in the autumn, it's just gorgeous.
So when I took this walk that day, again, this was like after, I think, the first major rain, but a week later, after I made that, as I'm walking along the Blue River, the trail there is, you know, higher and higher from the river itself.
Okay.
So I must have been 10 feet above looking down. But then I would look at the trees to the side of me, and they'd be filled with mud, which implied to me that the water got that high.
Yeah, I've never seen it flood like that, and I've been living along the river for 18 years.
So is that a bad thing in terms of, like...
Well, no, it's probably pretty good because it washes the river
right.
from all the stuff that people put in it. I mean, thank goodness for fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
It's just irreplaceable. But normally when it storms, you can see along the river. It's a strange thing to see, and I've got videos of it on YouTube, but the sewers actually erupt like a fountain just constantly.
Wow.
So you can see water just erupting out of the sewer, whatever they are, the sewer entryways, mm-hmm. and water will come out like 2 feet high. And
wow.
it's just amazing the amount of sewage that we put into the river every time it rains heavily.
So, wow. The last time we had you on the program, I forget the gentleman's name who we had with you, but who made the documentary that was on PBS about...
Right, Michael Price.
Right, that's it. So in this wonderful documentary, which is, I think we've shared it on an Eco Radio page, we'll do it again, but I think you can find it on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's about the whole water situation in Kansas City. So one of the things they touch on is that because of this sewer... Combined sewer overflow, the water is unacceptable. The water, this
oh,
is causing,
yeah.
So the EPA fined the city or not, or maybe decreed that the city must come up with the cost, must pay to clean that up?
I believe that's true, and I'm not, unfortunately, as expert as I should be in knowing what the city's process is, but they're creating a lot of improvements to stop water from overflowing in the sewers.
And so, but if I understand correctly, some of that is being funded by increased water bills.
Right.
Right, which is causing some water to be turned off because people can't afford it.
That's true.
Anymore. So so Kansas City is fighting to clean its own mess.
Thank goodness. I mean, that's
right.
And you know, I believe it's gone to votes and people have chosen to add money to through taxes to create a more sustainable water infrastructure.
Sure.
And we're in the middle of doing that, and that's a really good thing. We've got a long way to go. But as long as we can, while that process goes by, what we can do is make sure that we don't put really toxic things down our drains and down our toilets. Like
right.
Bleach is really a bad problem for rivers. And so whenever we put that down the sewer, it ends up in the river. It's really hard on wildlife.
So to be clear, when you say put it down the sewer, we're talking about using it in your washing machine,
sure,
or pouring it down your drain, or
sure,
or whatever, right?
Sure. Everything we put down our drains goes into the world. And one of the real amazing things is that when we flush our pee down the toilet, whatever drugs we're taking and haven't been metabolized by the body will end up in the waterway. So unfortunately, what water testing has shown is that there's chemicals and there's drugs, there's birth control, there's antidepressants. They're actually in detectable amounts in the rivers. And that's really hard on creatures that are trying to, not have birth control.
Right, right, right.
That's not their job. They need to multiply because their habitat is really stressed. So, whatever ways that we can try to avoid putting bad chemicals and drugs and things down our drains, that's one thing we can really do right now until they get the infrastructure finished.
And so this document, what was the name of the documentary?
It was called Water Rates. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
It was
on KCPT here in town. And
and it is on YouTube
And
now,
it is
too.
On YouTube, yeah. And so what I guess it was suggesting was that, so Kansas City's struggling to clean up its own mess, and gaining some ground there, but then by the same token losing some ground because there's additional pollutants being introduced into the Blue River via Indian Creek.
Right. Well, also Johnson County is the Blue River drain is the draining watershed from Johnson County too. So they are contributing plenty of pollutants, and of course the other problem that cities have is that we use a lot of salt in the winter, and that is really hard on wildlife.
Right. So is that most like, so the stuff coming from both maybe perhaps even the source of the Blue River, as well as the Indian Creek feeding into the Blue River further up north.
And Brush Creek, too.
And Brush Creek.
Brush Creek's been tested many times for a lot of E. coli.
Right. And I think it's Turkey Creek maybe that feeds into Brush Creek over on the Johnson County side. I think it's on the Kansas side.
Okay.
So it's not just salt, and it's not just prescriptions they've been taking.
Oil and dirt, actually, one of the things that really causes problems to a river is dirt.
Explain.
It's called turbidity. And what happens is when the way that nature is that all the rain and all the water and all the organic things filter through dirt, and then water flows out of the dirt like it's been filtered. But when people go and pave paradise, then what you end up with is that all the dirt and all the poisons and anything, salt, whatever there is, it can't filter through dirt anymore.
Right.
And so that really causes our rivers to be full of what's called turbidity, which is basically, if you go look at it, you'll see it kind of looks like dirt soup.
So when Kay Barnes was mayor of Kansas City, one of her big legacies, she was really pushing these rain gardens here in Kansas City, both on city property, but also encouraging, individual.
Yeah, and that kind of thing is easy to do. And plus, it's really actually beautiful. They're building a really interesting one around, I think it's around 78th and Troost. It is easy for us to participate with nature, even inside of cities, by doing things like, collecting rainwater and not flushing bad things. There are a lot of things we can do.
Okay. It sounds like some of the pollutants that are coming from Johnson County and also the Kansas City, Missouri side, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's nothing. This doesn't sound like there's anything unique about that. That same thing
it's
is being replicated all over the country,
all over the world.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious all over the world that we are not taking good enough care of the water. And it's one of the beautiful things that came out of the whole movement up at the Dakota Sioux Reservation at Standing Rock. Was people realizing how precious water is and how beautiful it is. It's just irreplaceable. And I think that if we could just get it into people's heads that water is beautiful and air is beautiful and it should be enjoyed and kept pure.
Mm. Yeah. So, what about fertilizers, pesticides, that kind of thing? Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, absolutely, of course. And that's one reason that there are a lot of things that we're doing that are going to be very difficult for us to get away from. Like, for example, peeing and pooing. It's just something people are going to be doing. But as far as fertilizer goes and pesticides and herbicides, we really don't need to kill clover for our survival at all. Right. Why don't we let clover grow? It's a beautiful thing. It feeds
it's also good
bees.
For the bees. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a Facebook page called Let My Clover Be, spelled B E E, and it's basically just to try to ask neighborhood groups to relax their standards and their laws, and allow people to let some natural growth happen in their yards, because it's good for so many reasons. You don't have to mow as much, which got to be good, but it feeds animals what they are naturally supposed to eat. A lot of people will plant butterfly plants and stuff like that, but they'll kill all their dandelions and all their clovers.
Right.
But that's not what bees eat, and it's not fair for us to go, hey, your food's ugly, so why don't you all die?
Okay, and so far we've described a lot of situations, challenges that the river's facing that are by no means unique. But one thing that is unique is the proximity of this weapons plant to both Indian Creek and more prominently Blue River.
Who would have figured that putting a nuclear weapons parts plant right by a main water tributary would be a bad idea for thousands of years? It is remarkable. But, we grew up in a time when people didn't really, they were just trying to survive, and they didn't really think how precious water is or how precious air is. But as we fill the world with so much human civilization, it's becoming obvious more and more, wow, water is a precious thing. And we've got to realize that we're just part of life, and we don't have a right to ruin all the water in the world just because we're humans and we're the most important species.
Right.
That's just wrong. We don't have the right to turn the world into our open drainage sewer.
Yeah. So they built this weapons plant there, in theory, we've heard otherwise, but in theory there were no nuclear components there, but recently they've detected uranium outside on the ground.
Yeah, there's uranium. There's a Facebook page if anyone's interested. It's called the Bannister Federal Complex Water Testing page.
Okay.
Right there, there's a bunch of papers. Links to papers by the government that will tell you all kinds of water quality tests and the environmental assessment that they made before they do an environmental assessment.
Who's they? Were we talking the EPA?
That would be the EPA, Missouri Department of Natural Resources, and the National Nuclear Security Agency, the NNSA, I believe, which is a part of the Department of Energy.
Correct.
And they list literally 1,000 different chemicals that have been detected on the Bannister Federal Complex, which are really not, they don't belong in our waterways. And right now they're transferring ownership from the Department of Energy to this company called CenterPoint, which is supposed to supervise what's called remediation, which is the, governmental word that has to do with cleanup.
Yeah, make it go away.
So it's really important that everyone who cares about this will make their voices heard while they're doing this remediation, where they are trying to find better ways to store the toxins that are left on this property. There's a great coalition, and there's a Facebook page for it called the Coalition Against Contamination.
Mm-hmm.
I'm part of that. We're all just working hard to make sure that they don't cover over the fact that there's a lot of toxic chemicals right by a river, and it's just a matter of time before the rain will come and wash those chemicals into the river, and that could happen for literally hundreds and hundreds of years.
So one point of clarification, the way I understand it, not the entire federal complex is being transferred to CenterPoint. Some of it is staying with, I think, GSA maybe, including a landfill.
Uh-huh.
And the landfill is the place that's the closest to the Blue River.
Yes.
And I, when you and I were at the same town hall a few months ago, I think it was at Center High School,
yeah.
And I asked, I think someone from the NSA, like, well, what's that landfill? And, well, that's been a landfill that's been there since the 40s. Well, what's in there? You know, it's a weapons plant, so, you know, explosive might be in there. And
well,
you know,
it's an old unlined landfill that's on the property next to Bendix. And it was back in the days when they'd throw away paint and they didn't really think about anything. So it's an unlined landfill, which means that it just leaches right into the river. There's a huge flap gate is what they call it. And it's straight out of Indiana Jones movie. I mean, and it's leaking this green water that is distinctively different in color than the river. And every day it's been leaking this water into the river right by the Prospect Bridge, which is where Prospect ends at Blue River Road.
Yeah.
It's an immense, very scary looking thing. And there's no plans to do much of anything that I know of to test the water at that site. And that's something that we need to get them to do, because we can't just have those kind of toxins leaking into the river forever.
So I thought the last time we had you on the program, you said that the EPA does test the water, but it's like 28 miles downstream, which really means it's not even the Blue River.
It's unbelievable.
Missouri River.
It took me like 3 months of Sunshine Law requests and phone calls and being a problem to them in power, which is, I must say, one of the most fun things that a person can do. But anyway, so to get any water quality testing results, and the ones that they provided were very rudimentary, just for E. coli. They didn't have any details about PCBs and other kinds of heavy, difficult chemicals. And then finally, they gave me one that was supposed to be the end-all, and it had some results for PCBs, but the water quality testing was being done 28 miles downstream, and 10 miles downstream from where the Blue River enters the Missouri River.
Right.
I mean, it's just an unbelievable idea that you would test water for something at 95th and 71 Highway 28 miles downstream.
Right, right.
After the Missouri River, how are you going to get accurate results? So, we really need to make sure that we get our government to get us good water quality testing results so we know what's going on.
So how do we do that?
Well, I think participating with things like the Coalition Against Contamination, get involved with it's kind of strange anymore, but just using Facebook is not a bad way to communicate with people. Just go to the Bannister Federal Complex Water Quality Testing Facebook page and, check it out. Leave some comments. And if you want a course, always get a hold of me. There's a lot of people who are trying really hard to help the river out. There's a lot of different organizations. One of the great ones that I'm really privileged to get to be part of is called the Project Blue River Rescue. Mm-hmm. And every year we get together, every spring. And I just really, if you love nature, this is a great time. Mm-hmm. There's a free lunch. We get thousands of people together every spring, and we meet at Lakeside Nature Center in Swope Park. And we just go out and clean up trash.
Wow.
All, across the whole Blue River.
Wow.
And it will really just make you go, wow, I cannot believe people care so little about this irreplaceable world that they just throw out their coffee cup and they just throw out their bags of McDonald's. And it's a stunning thing.
It is, yeah. It is. And so you're also involved with the Missouri Stream Teams?
Right.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
Well, the Missouri Department of Natural Resources has a project called the Stream Teams, and you can become involved in any tributary or creek or any stream, any river that you know, and you can become kind of the steward of that little creek or that little tributary or that little river, and you get to clean it up, and they give you a lot of resources about how to test water and see how good the water quality is just by looking at what kinds of insects are living there and what kinds of little animals are living in the water. So there it's just Missouri Department of Natural Resources stream teams, and they're easy to find on the web, and it's just a good thing, you know, for everybody to, the more that you spend time in nature, especially where you can see where humans are being careless with it. It's easy to see. There's trash all over the rivers. There's trash all over the roads in our parks. Mm. And when you get involved in that and clean it up for a while, it gets into your heart, and you realize how beautiful nature is and how easy it is for us to actually do things to make it better by just cleaning it up and getting involved with it and throw a skipper and, you know, get outside. It's good. It's good for your head, and it's good for the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, well put. So in terms of like contaminants from the federal complex, do we know, are there any independent tests being done?
There have been some independent tests done, especially some fantastic work by Don Wilkerson of the USGS. But there's just not enough releasing of the tests that are done on site. They have quite a number of what they call wells on the Bannister Federal Complex site, where each one actually tests the contaminants, but getting those water quality results is almost impossible. I haven't been able to. I think we really need to make phone calls and hold these people that are going to be responsible for the Bannister Federal Complex, and also make sure that we get results from the Missouri Department of Natural Resources. They're the ones who are really responsible to make sure what the water quality testing results are and make those public. We need to make sure they make that more public, easier to get at. And nowadays, with the computer, it should be much easier for us to find out.
Well, yeah, it should be easy to find out data that's been collected, but I would think it would also be easy and relatively inexpensive to collect data. In other words, why? Here's a couple of things I could think should be tested. For one, you know, they're going to start remediating whatever that's going to mean. Yeah. I'd like a benchmark test of what's in the water now,
exactly,
compared to what's in the water after they start stirring stuff up.
Right.
Right.
And what will be in the water then, once they're done with the process of cleaning up, supposedly, what will continue to leach into the river after they're done cleaning up. We need water quality testing for a long time for dangerous sites like Superfund sites and sites where there's a lot of toxic chemicals.
I'd also like to see, for example, like testing like right where you know, at the state line where Blue River comes into Missouri,
right.
And where the Indian Creek comes into, to see how much, you know, how much different is it, the same, just as
I totally agree. I mean, how can we really know what's going on if we don't test the water?
Right.
And how can we really evaluate, you know, how much Johnson County is contributing to a problem that Kansas City is having to be responsible for.
Right.
I do think that we need to make our voices heard, that we need better water quality testing results. It's 2017. There's no reason that after so many years, we're so still in the dark.
That's right. So, this is a very local issue. Obviously, it's impacting, you know, people in Kansas City in a very real way. But it's also kind of a global issue because just the Blue River feeds into the Missouri River, which feeds into the Mississippi, which feeds into the Gulf of Mexico, which is, has this what they call this dead zone.
The dead zone.
Where there's no oxygen.
Yeah, and coral is dying all over the world because of the added pH of global climate change. It's warmer now. So... And I was talking with Michael Price, the guy who did the documentary for KCPT, and he was talking about in England, you know, we were talking about how life is having a hard time here in America, and it's really struggling. And he said, well, it's pretty much done in England. I guess they've been polluting their streams for a longer period of time. And so the thing is that we as a human race, we've got to wake up to the responsibility that we have in terms of the way that we're harming water specifically. We're also harming the air, but it's a beautiful world and it's irreplaceable. And as long as we treasure it, you know, we'll be able to enjoy it. And as soon as we start thinking that it doesn't matter what we do, what we put down the drain, it doesn't matter who we vote for, I think we know now that you just can't vote for somebody who prioritizes profit over the long-term sustainable life of our world. I understand that people need work, but we're going to have to respond to the fact that we can't have everything we want carelessly. We have got to be participators in life in this because it is a beautiful, beautiful world.
Yeah, well said. I'm going to play, actually, I think we're just about, let me see. I'm going to go to Climate Connections right now, and we'll be back. Oops, I played the wrong game.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio.
Well, wait, we'll try that again. Let's try this again. All right, so we'll go to Climate Connections now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Sports teams like the Brooklyn Nets and LA Kings score points on the court and ice. Meanwhile, their parent company is shooting for some goals of its own. John Marler is Vice President of Energy and Environment at AEG, a company that owns sports teams, stadiums, and entertainment venues around the world. He says the company has ambitious goals for reducing its greenhouse gas emissions, conserving water, and reducing waste across all its operations and venues.
We do what we can to minimize our emissions and to constantly look for ways we can make incremental improvements.
AEG stadiums now include sustainability features, ranging from on-site gardens to major energy-saving programs. The Staples Center in LA can generate up to a fifth of its power from rooftop solar panels. And the Barclays Center in Brooklyn has a huge green roof that reduces heat absorption on hot days. Marler says it's about more than the energy saved.
So we have 100 million sports entertainment fans that come through our doors every year. And if we can engage with them about sustainability and communicate what we're doing, that can have a really big multiplier effect and amplify what we're already doing.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
After publishing a paper on the impact of Google Fiber's selection of Kansas City as its inaugural market and its impact on the prospects for increased equity across the digital divide, Dr. Shannon Jackson, professor of anthropology at UMKC, has started to look at the Kansas City, Missouri Water Department's adoption of the Internet of Things and big data. She will discuss the motivation and thinking behind her new research on this week's program. Join us on All Souls Forum Wednesday evenings at 6 p.m. here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Evan Smalley, I really want to thank you for coming in.
Oh, thank you. It's amazing that there's a great program like this that just tells people about different things that are going on with their environment, with people. And in KC, a lot of people love nature and it's just nice to get to say hi to all y'all.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again, and I hope you'll come back and join us. Well,
thank you.
Just got a few items, events coming up. The Missouri Green Schools Environmental Educational Conference, hosted by Missouri Environmental Education Association and the Kansas City Zoo. This will place at the zoo on November 3rd and 4th, where educators will share their experiences developing a green school, aligning environmental education to STEM, and working on certification and programs for preschoolers. Also on November 6th from 7 to 9 p.m., journalist Carrie Gillum talks about toxic dangers of the common pesticide glyphosate, detailed in her new book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer and the Corruption of Science. And that will be 7 to 9 at November 6th, which is a week from today, at Village Presbyterian Church, 6641 Mission Road. And I guess I got time to tell you one more. What do we need to know about the native bees that buzz in Johnson County? A local biologist will reveal the plight of these pollinators at a presentation on the bees of Johnson County. And this is Mike Arducer, who will speak at the Johnson County Parks and Rec building at Shawnee Mission Park, 7900 Renner Road in Shawnee, Kansas. That's 6:45. Not this Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. And that about does it for our events. This podcast will be up shortly, so if you missed part of it, you get to hear the whole thing again. We're going to go out, I think, with some music this week. So here's a good one from Stan Slaughter, and this is called Stream Team.